Explode your to-be-read pile with the New Release Index, your new best friend for finding the best new books. Curated by the book nerds here at Book Riot, it will help you keep track of the upcoming books we think should be on your radar. You can filter by genre, what's trending among other subscribers, and save books to your own watch list. And you can check out the demo at bookriot.com/new-releases. That's bookriot.com/new-releases. Happy browsing!
Hello and welcome to the Book Riot Podcast. It's a weekly news and talk show about what's new, cool, and worth talking about in the world of books and reading. Today is Thursday, August 3rd, 2023. Jeff O'Neill with Rebecca Shinsky. Kind of a light news week this week, which is kind of, we were just talking about it before the show. It's funny, Rebecca and I have taken on duties of alternating weeks of writing Book Riot's daily newsletter. That's weird. called Today in Today in Books, in which we highlight the most interesting bookish list pieces going around that day. It can be a list, can be an article, an opinion piece, news, you know, profile, whatever it might be. And even though we've been doing that, and we've been prospecting links for a million years, so that's one reason we took it over. It's like, we're kind of doing this already anyway. And we link to a lot of stuff, but that's different than that's makes for a good podcast segment. So, A, go check out Today in Books if you want to see us round stuff up. Some of that stuff we'll make into the agenda. I'll put a link in the show notes, or you can go to bookriot.com/newsletters and find it there. Or todayinbooks.substack.com is the URL. Those are all harder things than looking at the show notes and clicking on the link. So maybe we did this last time because we ran out of time to have substantive discussions of some of the links there. Maybe one thing we can do is add a segment to the show where we just say, here are the links that, you know, were popping off in Today in Books. They may not merit a discussion. because I linked on Tuesday to a list of 75 books for Gen Xers. And it was kind of fun, but also wrong and right. And it's worth looking at, but we're not going to talk about that. Did we used to do stuff? We talk about a list that's not a nominations list or an award winning list.
No.
I feel like we used to do stuff like that, but I can't really recall now.
Every now and then, maybe. Maybe before the internet was built primarily of lists.
Yeah, that's fair. There's so many.
We might have done that. You know, one of the things, I'm on duty for most of this week. I was on PTO on Tuesday when you covered. So one of the things that I'm featuring in Today in Books today is that the Broadway musical of The Notebook by Nicholas Sparks is set to open in March. So if that's a thing that you're into.
Are you going back to back opening? You're going to go opening night and the next night? Or are you going to give them a couple weeks to iron out the kinks and then go for a long weekend and do like a triple play?
Are they going to pay me to go? Is this my moment to be an influencer?
Rebecca, I've got bad news for you. If you end up in a place where you're paying your bills by doing influencers for Nicholas Sparks musicals, a lot of things in your life will have changed.
Yeah. That would be a dark moment. Yeah. I do like Ingrid Michaelson, who is a singer-songwriter who wrote the music for the show, so that was an interesting thing to see. The endurance of the story in The Notebook, and that people, like, now we're into the second, maybe third generation of readers who are paying attention to that. I kind of wonder, I think it's movie fans, honestly, more than book fans that are there. But that was interesting to see. We are going to talk today about one of the things I linked to in yesterday's Today in Books, about gamification and how gamification is changing the way that we read. But I've also just been noticing a bunch of really interesting conversations and interviews around bookish stuff that happens on Substack. And as we've talked about, like, the author interview that's not about what's your writing routine and where do you get your ideas is kind of a rare and glorious thing to find. And I've been subscribing to a Substack for a while called The Shift with Sam Baker, which is the companion to her podcast of the same title. It's about women over 40 and, like, what it's like to be a woman aging. But she did this great long podcast interview with Barbara Kingsolver. And they talked about aging and being from Appalachia and also all sorts of stuff from Kingsolver's childhood, how she was a musical prodigy of sorts. And like pretty good at math. The headline that I wrote in was Barbara Kingsolver on aging Appalachia and algebra, because we love alliteration. But that was one of the things I featured. And so you can, like, you know, check that out and also find a new Substack to subscribe to, perhaps. I'm feeling very validated that my, like, multi-years long Substack addiction is now a part of my work.
It's all coming up, really Shinsky. Nicholas Spark musicals and Substacks coming to the center of the culture.
Yes, yes.
We joke a lot. I'm not even sure it's joking. I'm not even sure what it is. What is life? What is discourse? Language is slippery. Oh, signs and significations. Wow, I really went there.
Really in August here, my friend.
Well, you know, when we say from time to time, are we sure this person isn't the most interesting person in the world? We're both being ironical and not at the same time. Like, it's hyperbole, but we're also commenting that person is interesting. I think we should keep a running list of people we even say that ironical thing about, because Barbara Kingsolver is what I'm hearing. Maybe should go on the list of contenders for most interesting person in the world / the bookish world.
I agree.
Yeah.
I like this list.
I don't know. Nicholas Sparks is going to make it. He's sold enough. Speaking of musicians, interesting people, this is a shout to the next episode of First Edition, which is coming out next week. So I guess by the time you're listening to this, if you're not a Patreon and getting it early, will be Wednesday, the 9th. A full episode with James McBride, a Reading Lives episode where I talk about his reading life. Also a musician, also a super interesting person. Talk about his childhood growing up in Brooklyn and then his time at Oberlin and being a musician and reading books and being one of 12 kids.
Oh my gosh, I didn't realize that.
Right. And then, you know, going to journalism school. He told me that he went to Columbia School for Journalism and got in. Kind of wasn't expecting to because it's prestigious and it's competitive, so you know it's reasonable to think you may not get in. He gets in, doesn't have a lot of reportage experience, and the reading they send reading to do over the summer before, and it's The Power Broker by Robert Caro. And I said, wow, wasn't that intimidating? He's like, oh my god, yes. I was like, it was amazing. It's like, you know, it's like I don't know how to do any of this. So
that's the weed out assignment.
I guess so. So
that's incredible.
I think we'll talk about having a grocery store in the frontless foyer today. We both read it recently, and we have nice things to say about it there. So go check that out, First Edition. We also did the August It books. The September It books are going to come out, you know, at the end of this month. We're getting down to it now. With September coming, Heaven Earth Grocery Store versus Tom Lake by Ann Patchett was kind of the final boss match of the knockout round we did. I hope I'm not spoiling it for people who haven't got to it yet, but go subscribe if you don't want to. I thought I would take stock real quick because I was telling you yesterday that our heart votes for the McBride rather than our head votes for the Patchett took a couple of hits, and one by the name of Reese Witherspoon, the other by the names of Barnes & Noble, picking the Patchett for the Books of the Month. Apple Books bailing us out today by making Heaven and Earth Grocery Store.
Good job, Apple.
One of their picks of their pick of the month. Now, I've got this on, it's not deep background. Someone wrote in that's a bookseller. And I'm not going to say the state or anything because they asked for not all of this to be identifiable. But in response to our fervent hope that Heaven and Earth would be the winner, or you know, winner, loser, this is all silly, but like to have a life, right? To be a thing.
Yes. Have some legs.
Their bookstore every year has, I don't know if it's a shelf or a list or whatever, but each bookseller picks their best of the year. But so many of them were picking Heaven and Earth that they just decided to have a bookstore pick of the year, and then everyone could pick something else.
Love that.
Either that or half of the shelf would have been Heaven and Earth Grocery Store.
I love that. So good for them and for James McBride. I was thinking about how this is the kind of literary fiction that we would usually see in September or October. And I couldn't decide if James McBride sort of got the shaft getting dropped into early August when folks are still like Tom Lake is a very summer book. Yeah. It's great. It's Ann Patchett. It's reliable. You know, I talked about it last week and it's a very summery kind of book. The Heaven and Earth Grocery Store does feel a little bit more like a fall reading prize contender kind of sitch. And I'm torn about, did he get the shaft there or was this wise to drop him into this time when that book can kind of stand alone as the lit fic star of a week or two before we get into Zadie, Jesmyn, you know, all the heavy hitters that are coming in the fall. But James McBride can certainly stand among those folks. Yep. So I don't know. It's interesting. I'd like to hear about the strategy of publishing James McBride on August 1st.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, we have talked, I think we talked about it on the show, this one or the other one or someplace, about McBride still feeling not in the correct rank of mindshare for people that like books, even having had Good Lord Bird and Deacon King Kong. And he wrote Miracle at St. Anna, the novel that became the Spike Lee movie, which is historical fiction, as a lot of his stuff is. But I've got to say, and I don't think it made an interview. I think I had stopped recording. We kind of talked for a little while after. I'll say this. He's so grateful to have had his opportunities. Like, I've had my 15 minutes. You know, I'm going to keep writing, but, you know, I got more than I could ever want. So, Rebecca, we're wrong, and James McBride is fine. And we don't need to worry about him.
James McBride is more gracious than we are, but I'm going to, like, continue carrying my flag that he's criminally under-celebrated until I see him being appropriately celebrated. Yeah.
Well, he's got a good teaching gig in Columbia. He's had some adaptations. He's worked with Spike Lee on
some other stuff too.
He seems like he's doing great and in a really warm and wonderful interview. That's a long promo.
But James McBride is more adjusted, better adjusted
to
than
his
we
life
are.
Than we are. Yeah. You know what? Maybe that's one thing we should. Maybe this is a half baked idea. It's like, maybe we should have certain sort of like reciprocal grudge holding. So you don't have to hold your own grudge, but you could, like, you know, pass the grudge around. Yeah, so I'm having your grudge, you have mine. It makes it all easy to bear. Yeah, it doesn't feel so narcissistic.
Our dear friend and former book rioter, Amanda Nelson, does this in real life with our friends. She calls it the grudge box.
Oh, does she?
Like, oh, that person. Yeah. If you're telling her a story about somebody who did you wrong, like, you might be unburdened, but she's like, well, that's in the grudge box now. That guy's in the grudge box forever.
That might be the most Amanda Nelson thing I've ever heard, maybe.
You know, and it's a service. It does feel like, okay, I don't have to hold this grudge because Nelson's got it.
She's got it.
I would be happy to be the bearer of the grudge box for, you know, many of the acclaimed literary authors of the day. That's fine with me. Let's do it.
It's like hiring an assassin that has no relation to you. So, like, the motive is really strange. Like, when someone gets murdered, it's like, well, I don't understand. It's like someone, like, slashes your tires one day and the person has an alibi that has the grudge, but Amanda has the straight razor and she got you while you were at Bed Bath & Beyond.
The grudge box. It's a thing.
Let's do a sponsor break. We'll come back.
Explode your to-be-read pile with the New Release Index, your new best friend for finding the best new books. Curated by the book nerds here at Book Riot, it will help you keep track of the upcoming books we think should be on your radar. You can filter by genre, what's trending among other subscribers, and save books to your own watch list. And you can check out the demo at bookriot.com/new-releases. That's bookriot.com/new-releases. Happy browsing.
This is follow-up time. So this is, I think I teased this to you on the show last week. Someone wrote in with some Barnes & Noble, maybe everything isn't quite so hunky-dory as it seems. There was another James Daunt Barnes & Noble profile this week. This one in the Wall Street Journal.
He's got a good publicist.
So I think this could relate. Well, it definitely relates in this regard, but I think it may have a longer game implication. I'm going to protect this person's name, and I'm not going to go through too many specifics of geography here, except to say one thing that this person says is happening at Barnes & Noble stores is that pushing this new paid membership thing that Barnes & Noble has been doing. I think we talked about this on the show, of going from this free get 10% off to, is it $50 a year, $35 a year? It doesn't really matter, but a subscription base where you're paying an annual fee for some perks and free shipping and whatever is the primary way. Now, this is secondhand. I haven't reported this myself. The primary way that managers are getting promoted, hired, retained, and fired. The goal of retention and conversion of people into that paid thing is what is determining the success of a store right now, or especially the employees of the store. And it's pretty competitive because if you're not competing up to a certain level of a store that's in the same city, I think, or a median for the group or whatever, then you're on the hook. And that's a different story than you're seeing in these James Dot, we're letting the booksellers do what they want, and this is everything for readers. Like, that's not the story. That's not being mentioned here. I don't think I've seen a mention of the membership metrics in any of these James Dot is here to tell you how to run indie bookstores like it's a chain stories.
Right. Yeah, I haven't seen that mentioned anywhere either. But that was also part of my bookselling experience there, like 12 or 13 years ago, because the membership has always been paid, but now it's the tiered thing. And educators, previously it was that educators got a discount just for signing up, but now even educators, I think, have to pay. So they changed what the paid membership model looks like. But this conversion to a paid membership has been a focus of Barnes & Noble for a while. It sounds like maybe it's become more intense, but I remember that was a way that folks got promoted to be at the time Barnes & Noble had leads of different departments of the store. I don't know if they still do it that way, but if you were going to be the cash wrap lead, you had to have demonstrated that you were good at selling memberships because you were going to spend the bulk of your shifts at the cash wrap rather than helping out on the sales floor or at the info desk or something. I'm pretty sure it was part of managers' metrics. We did talk about it in staff meetings, but it's interesting that there's such a gap between the sort of rosy look at how much power we're giving the bookstores, publicity pieces and the James Dot kind of fluff that's going around and the kind of boots on the ground bookseller experience of being pressured to generate revenue this way. Like, I understand why Barnes & Noble wants it, because you sign up for this thing and it probably auto renews. And that is some annual guaranteed recurring revenue that they can look at when they're budgeting. But that's putting that kind of pressure on. I don't remember anything as detailed as like competitions between booksellers or anything. I don't think I knew anything about how good I was at selling memberships against any of my coworkers at the time.
Right.
So that's interesting to hear that it's getting a little more cutthroat, and that, just interestingly, nobody's talking about that bit when they're talking about how wonderful it is.
Well, it's
now.
It's less true than it once was, where you'd go, do you remember you used to go into Office Depot or Best Buy and you'd buy a printer and they'd want to upsell you on the warranty for 10 years for more than the cost of the printer? And I know some people that worked in those stores, and there was bonuses attached to those, or performance measures of other kind, so they really wanted to push those, what's get measured, what's get managed. I think there's something in big box retail, and Barnes & Noble is still that, even as much as they want to be, we're indie bookstores, but at scale. The ability of individual employees to change the sales vector of that store is probably quite a bit smaller than their ability to affect the bottom line by pushing a membership, right? Someone's going to come in and buy a book. Are you going to get them to buy four more books? Maybe if you're an indie bookseller and you're really, really good at it, and you have the time and attention, whatever. I'm actually going to interview a bookseller soon for First Edition, has a book about the art of bookselling, so I've been reading about that. And then Office Depot or Best Buy, are you really going to be able to get them into a new flat screen TV or not? I guess maybe, but what you maybe can do is get them to spend $200 on a warranty that they weren't going to buy anyway.
As you were saying that, and I was thinking more about that this has been a part of the Barnes & Noble model, maybe just the fact that it has been a part of the model and this is not a thing that's uncommon across big box retail explains why it's not mentioned there. I was also a barista at Starbucks. They train, the first thing they train you to do is try to upsell a person to the next size.
Yep.
You wanted a latte? Was that a venti?
What do we got to do to get you into a double caramel venti frappuccino today?
Right. You ordered your venti caramel frappuccino. Do you want some cake pops to go with that? These are basic retail tactics that are so common as to be deeply unremarkable and really not worth noting anywhere. But maybe the increased pressure around it could reflect. I'd be curious if we had follow up from this person. Does the increased pressure around this membership reflect, is this membership harder to sell than the old membership was? Is the new model not working as well?
I think on a membership per membership basis, it's more expensive. So one thing you're asking for here too, if any other Barnes & Noble booksellers have info, I'll protect, whatever. But if this is your experience as well, shoot us an email, podcast@bookriot.com. So I wonder if this Dot publicity tour, the Laurel receiving, ending at the Wall Street Journal is telling, because the Wall Street Journal is a financial publication. Mm-hmm. And remember that Barnes & Noble was bought by a group that is a private equity firm. Private equity is not happy with running losses for a million years. And they often don't keep their companies forever. It depends. It can change. I wouldn't be shocked if Barnes & Noble goes up for sale soon or goes public again pretty soon, because this is what you do when you're taking the, you know, if you're getting ready to take the cow to market, you show it off at the 4-H fair first. And that really seems like that's what they've been doing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it would certainly, something like that would certainly explain retroactively why James Daunt has been on this publicity parade.
Yeah.
Other than just let's let the world know that James Daunt, it sounds like he's good at his job, or wants you to believe that he's good at his job, and has turned this Barnes & Noble ship back around.
Yeah.
Be interesting to see how that shakes out.
Some other follow-up on my kind of last minute noodle, throwaway noodle about some sort of authors cooperative model where but more like the NBA, the National Basketball Association, where the salaries of the players in total are a fixed percentage of the gross revenue of the league itself. And one listener said, you know, this sounds like to me like the beginning of United Artists, which, you know, some early movie stars got together to form United Artists because they could have more control, to get more of their revenue, and so on and so forth. I read the Wikipedia article, and I could not follow whether or not that central ethos or financial arrangement has endured, because it like got sold to something that got sold to something else that became MGM, which is now part of Amazon. And I would be very shocked if the guys, the guys and gals and others at the Big Red A are like, yeah, we're giving 50% of all the MGM gross revenue to Charlie Chaplin's descendants or whatever. I just don't feel like that's possible. But also this week, and I don't know if you linked to it or not, there was the announcement in Publishers Weekly. I don't think I put the link in the agenda. I'm sorry about that. For this new publishing venture house called Bindery. Did this go across your radar this week at all, Rebecca? This thing?
Oh, I saw it. I think it was last week, but yeah, I did see that.
It's essentially a new publishing venture that is pairing traditional publishing things like printing books and editing them and distributing them with the power of social influencers, and making a social influencer part of the business plan and also part of the revenue cut for titles. So it works something like this. I'll find a show notes, put in their book. The company's called Bindery, where essentially Bindery will present to influencers that it's signed deals with some potential titles that it wants to acquire. And then the influencers say, yeah, I'll get behind this one. And I'll TikTok about it, I'll tweet about it, I'll Instagram, I'll use whatever they're doing. And let's be honest, it's mostly Instagram Reels and TikTok at this point, I think. And then in exchange, I'm going to get a cut of the business. I'm not going to get a flat fee. I'm going to get a cut.
Mm-hmm.
And someone emailed to say, this sounds like what you're talking about. And it does sound that way. But what I would encourage people who don't know is to investigate the difference between gross revenue and net revenue. Because this model, authors get 50% of net revenue. In the NBA, I believe they get 50% of gross revenue. I know it's gross. I don't know if it's 50%. There's just been a new bargaining contract. I don't know. But the difference between net and gross is the difference between your computer mouse and a field mouse. They're wildly different things. Gross revenue is the total dollars taken in. The net revenue, it's what's left as profit after costs and everything have been taken into account. So an author getting 50% of net revenue, that is a bigger percentage. But me, without even seeing the sales, I would take 15% of the growth right now, which is what most authors get from a traditional publishing company right there. Because there's ways of messing with net. Famously, Peter Jackson had to sue to get his profit share of a little movie franchise called Lord of the Rings because New Line Cinema claimed it did not turn a profit, which is insane. So be careful when you see those types of things. The way the NBA works is like the players have such power, the LeBron Jameses, the Kobe's, you know, they're such marquee celebrities that we say, if we don't play, you don't have a league. And they said, and I don't care, and we don't care, this is how we can set it up, and you guys take your profit out of what you can do on your side. We're part of the cost of goods sold, essentially, and here's our fixed price. And they've unioned, and they struck, and they've done all those sorts of things about it. So this sounds this way. What's different about this is influencers being part of the deal. This is not a better deal for authors, it seems to me. There's a flat advance and everything else like that. But this is not what I'm talking about. It looks kind of like it is, but it is not that, because it's gross, not net. And I should have made that distinction here. Anyway, so Rebecca, am I right? Am I wrong? What do you think about that sort of take on it?
I mean, I think you're absolutely right about taking the 15% on gross rather than 50% on net. I'm not sure how, I mean, like a bestseller, if you're an influencer and you push a billion copies of something that's going to sell or that is selling really well, that might be better than the deals you're getting as an affiliate for other things you're an influencer for. So this might fall somewhere in the middle there. I'm really curious to see who will be participating in it. I saw the announcement of Bindery, and then I stumbled just sort of in my own internet wandering, or actually it stumbled on me in my Instagram feed. Catherine Budig, who started as like one of the first like yoga influencers maybe a decade or so ago. She has just over 200,000 Instagram followers on her personal Instagram, but she loves to read and started a book club through a platform that she runs that has, the book club's called The Inky Phoenix. It has like 12,300 followers, and she is one of the influencers who's going to be part of Bindery. And I was just like scrolling through my Instagram last week and saw her announcement. And I was like, oh, interesting. Like on her personal feed, that there's that 200K followers. On the book club feed, there's the 12,000. She's been picking a book every month that is just a book she likes and is encouraging people to read, and they do some discussion around. I don't think she gets any like kickback on those sales. Mm. So maybe her thinking here is that she will be choosing some of the, you know, Bindery titles as her book club titles going forward, and then she'll be able to make more than she would make if she was doing like bookshop revenue for them. I would love to, you know, hear more about that process and about how they're doing recruiting for this. Like, I think you can apply as a tastemaker for Bindery, or you could reach out to them. You can join the wait list if you want to be on there. But how did they recruit the first round of folks who are going to be their influencers for this is something I would love to hear more about. I think it's interesting, like, to try to thread a bunch of needles, like create a business model that supports publishing and authors and also has the influencer stuff built in. But I think it relies on it assumes that influencers will continue to be important. And the more algorithmatized all of our, you know, social media experiences get, I think the less weight the individual influencer
has. That's my question about it too.
Right. We're moving away from social media and towards recommendation media like TikTok, where the algorithm just serves you the things that it thinks you like. And you're no longer going through this mediated experience of like, I follow Catherine Budig. I like her. She recommends this yoga mat. I will try it. It's just TikTok giving you, here's a yoga thing you might like. I don't know. I'm still not on TikTok and don't plan to be, but this is my understanding of how algorithms function. Yeah. So the ongoing reliance on influencers, or building a brand new business on the assumption that influencers continue to be a primary mechanism for people discovering things and buying them, is the biggest question mark of this for me. But as an attempt to pull a bunch of those pieces together, this looks about as interesting as I think one could be.
I think it's an interesting failure in the making to me for a couple reasons.
Yeah.
And, you know, you're right about things until you're wrong, or you're wrong about things till you're right. You know, it's a gambler's fallacy to think it's going to be other than it is until it isn't. A couple of questions about it. Putting aside the revenue splits and all that kind of stuff, the fundamental idea is this, that let's say I'm a big TikTok influencer. Is my ability to select a book from a pile and then do enough on my own soch to get it to move more units than it would have traditionally published, is that consistent enough where you're picking one? Because it's one a year. You can't do that many of these. And I think how a lot of the social media works, it's very rare that a single person, unless you're Bigless Dickless, and that's lightning in a bottle, you just can't plan for this. And this requires a lot of planning. Got to select this one. Yeah. And this is the one I'm going to have to consistently get behind it. And the way the social stuff works is that one person then to be joined by other smaller or bigger or really love it and then have reasons to get behind it themselves. And I just don't know that that's replicable or even... I think you need to be betting a lot of chips to get one to pay off. This feels like putting a lot of weight behind one chip, and you just don't know what's going to take off. You just don't know.
I think the betting framework there is a really helpful way to think about it because, like, TikTok is a slot machine.
Right.
And very few of the times that you pull the lever do you win, if any of them. If you're somebody who's advertising your stuff there or building content about the thing you're trying to sell and hoping some of it will go viral. And especially knowing that TikTok is creating its own publishing arm where it presumably is going to leverage the algorithm on its own behalf. Anything, like, one would assume if they're putting their thumb on the scale for the books that they produce, there will be a negative impact on attempts to influence TikTok users to sell other kinds of books or books from other producers. I think it falls into the same kind of logical fallacy that we see happen on whatever the social media thing of the year is, of like, well, this thing worked really well organically. There were some organic sensations. Yeah. So let's just try to engineer it. And the thing that we kind of repeatedly say about those is I understand why that someone feels the need to try this. I feel like I can also see why it won't work. But if you're just looking at that one sensation, like, we could try to capture this. I understand the urge to try to capture it. I just feel like I'm too old on the internet to think it can be captured.
Yeah. I mean, I guess a good thought experiment, if you're an influencer out there or someone pretending, or not pretending, but like, you could do this thought experiment of like, let's say I was, I don't know. Yeah. Well, we kind of do this with the It book, right? I'm looking at a bunch of books, and remember, I'm not getting to pick from the Viking list or whatever. Like, the people that are getting, you know, the Emily, you're not picking Emily Henry, right? They're not getting, they're not going to Bindery for a $10,000 advance in this thing. So put that to the side for a minute. You're looking at probably either early career, underknown manuscripts, and your ability as an influencer to say, this is the one that's going to work. Okay, well, would you have done that 6 years ago with the things that took off? Would you have picked, this is how you lose the time war? You would not have.
Right.
You know, you just wouldn't have. And you also don't get to pick Colleen Hoover because that was happening before you were on TikTok, whoever you are. You don't get to pick Emily Henry. You don't get to pick Sarah J. Maas. You're picking, maybe you're not picking The Fourth Wing after it's already been published. You're picking The Fourth Wing off a pile of books just like it or a lot like it. What I'm saying is, I have enough humility about my own taste and how books work in culture that it is way harder than people think to pick what's going to... Like, this is William Goldman. This is like 101. Like, if you think you can do it, I've got a bridge to sell you about how this works.
Right. It's really hard. You know, I think we could sit here today and make some... We could try to make some predictions about, like, 5 years from now, what kinds of books are going to be big. And we would be wrong. Yeah. We would be wrong. The things that become these big sensations, like, part of the reason or the primary reason that there's a story around how these books became big sensations is that it was unpredictable in some way, surprising in some way. And usually when publishing sets out to make a book a bestseller, it either succeeds, and so it's not really a story because we knew it was going to be a bestseller, and oh, surprise, there it is. Or, like, in the thing I will never get over is Hachette publishing an ebook about how they made Chad Harbach's debut novel, The Art of Fielding, a bestseller before the book was even published.
The Greek gods don't like that. That, you know, that's Oedipus doing stuff. Like, yeah, I'll figure this out.
And I can figure out why the plague is
hitting Thebes. Let me get into that. I'm sure it'll be fine.
Yeah, nobody's done that again. We haven't seen a repeat. They haven't run that one back for another go. But these things are, they're ineffable. They're unpredictable. It's word of mouth.
That's
and
right.
And as I think, as you have put it so succinctly on past episodes, social media is just how we're doing word of mouth today, or recommendation media is just how we're doing word of mouth today, but it can't really be manipulated or harnessed. And looking at what's popular today, which is probably influencing, you know, what kinds of manuscripts are going to show up for these influencers to choose from at Bindery, you're going to get a lot of stuff, as you were saying, that reflects what's popular right now, but that is not a prediction of what's going to be popular by the time you have to try to sell this book. And, you know, maybe if you're an author and you have struck out at the traditional publishing places, like a $10,000 advance from Bindery is better than a $0 advance from, you know, from nowhere. It's also $10,000 more than you are guaranteed if you put your book up as a self-published title on Amazon and you just hope that someone on TikTok likes you and then you win the self-publishing lottery. Right. So it's not the worst choice a person could make, but I think Bindery is going to have a very tough time competing for desirable titles. Like, you're not going to win something that's at auction, you know, on this. So it's sort of an acknowledgement of taking, you know, like the remainders of things that big publishing didn't pick, and trying to sell those things with a much different kind of marketing engine than what big five publishers have, or just traditional publishers in general. Yep. Have access to. So it's not the worst fallback option for an author, but I don't see anything here that tells me this would be an author's first choice.
No, not as an author's first choice. I guess I'm trying to think, is there like, again, if we could get all the information, let's say in 5 years we get one piece of information, I would ask for this from Binder. No, I, this is what I would pick. Did a higher percentage of their authors earn out than at a traditional publishing house? That'd be the single metric, because they're basically saying, rather than spending this money, well, I don't know. Looking at the net, it's hard to say, but we're going to give influencers more a cut that they don't get. So that money has to come from somewhere. There's only so many dollars in a $14.99 commercial paperback, right? We're going to give them that money instead of spending it on something else. Either our bottom line, take it out of our profit. Well, I got to tell you, there's not a lot of profit in books to begin with. I'm thinking they're basically outsourcing marketing and publicity. All the stuff a traditional publisher would do on marketing and publicity that's earned and paid media is going to be offloaded. That's what we're hiring them to do in the form of pay, a percentage. Might that work in aggregate? Maybe. But I'm guessing these books will still follow sort of the 80-20 power law we see in regular books, that 20% of the titles are going to pay for 80. So maybe there's one of these that turns into a big hit. And that's great for Bindery, but what about those four other influencers? Are they going to be super happy about it? And just because influencer A, who had the big hit this cycle, doesn't mean they're going to want to be the one that gets it next cycle.
Right. I mean, that's using the, like, you know, lottery, gambling, just what we know about statistics and probability method. If you are the influencer who gets the big hit the first year, the smartest thing that you could do would be back out of Bindery in an ongoing
fashion.
Like, take your
when
money.
You double down
right.
on
you leave
your split
when you're
aces.
Up.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
Right. You walk away while you're up and then, you know, go do something else, right. But don't assume that you're going to win that influencer lottery twice.
And maybe it feels we're wrong. Like, maybe we're wrong. Maybe the taste of people on these platforms for. This is I'm influencer X, and you love and follow my stuff. I don't want to discount that at all. And you will buy this book that I didn't write, and that I'm doing a bunch of disclosed SponCon around. That's going to turn into sales. We'll see. It's an interesting thing, but like most experiments, you should assume they'll fail. And I'm not going to update my Bayesian prior because of this.
Right? Yeah, I think that's exactly right. Maybe we will be wrong about it. Who knows? This would be an interesting one to be wrong about. More interesting than some of the other experiments that we've seen. But just fascinating watching it feels like Mad Libs at this point, like the ongoing permutations of publishing plus influencing plus step three profit. And kind of feels like watching folks learn the wrong lesson. Like, I was talking to a friend last week about, you know, how amazing the Barbie movie is and how Mattel seems to have learned the wrong lesson, because they walked away from the Barbie success and were like, yes, now we're going to make Polly Pocket movies, movies about other Mattel franchises. And like, it's not the franchise that made the Barbie movie great. It's the Greta Gerwig genius that makes the Barbie movie what it is. Like, maybe you could do that with Polly Pocket if you point also Greta Gerwig or someone equally brilliant at it, but the lesson that Mattel learned there seemed to be like, yes, the world is hungry for franchise movies. Let's do it. Get out all the toys. And it feels kind of like that's what's happening in publishing, is people are like, look, someone convinced someone else to buy a book on the internet, and so we should try that same thing instead of understanding that word of mouth functions because it feels organic.
Yeah.
Or because it often is organic, and this trying to capture it and manipulate it has not yet worked. That doesn't mean it won't ever, but we haven't yet seen somebody successfully like harness the TikTok and make it do the same thing on purpose that it did for Colleen Hoover by surprise.
Right. Well, I mean, it doesn't have to be, it could be Sarah J. Maas. It could be, you know, Matt Haig in the Midnight Library. Like, you can have successes that are different than that, but like, those are hard in hindsight to have picked ahead of time. And I think the Barbie movie is a good example. And I was thinking about this and seeing those same, that same cursed litany of future projects that they were putting out there. And I was like, this happens a lot in culture, is where someone catches lightning in a bottle and they think they're Zeus. It's like, no.
Yes.
No.
And also they misunderstood what the lightning was.
Yeah, right. That's not lightning. That's a lightning bug or something like that. And it doesn't hurt that the movie, by all accounts, is good, right? You can make a bad something that could have been good because of the ethos or whatever. I don't think the Oppenheimer Barbie thing became a thing. You can't plan for that, you know?
No.
I mean, Oppenheimer probably benefited more than Barbie, but Barbenheimer as a hashtag and all the marketing, like, it all matters. You can't, you just cannot replicate that. And everyone did their job. Sometimes everyone can do a great job and have good ideas and the product can be good and it still doesn't work. Have fun figuring that. That's just the truth.
Good luck.
It's really hard. And it goes back to what we were talking about last week, is because there's so many chips on the table. There's so many cards in the deck. I'm mixing my gambling metaphors, but there's so many people competing for that bottle and that lightning. You got to be really good. Now, maybe the smaller stakes of this make sense. Maybe for a $10,000 advance, they'll find that these really big influencers, there's some that are huge and they get huge views. Maybe that's enough to put it over the edge. I don't think it's going to be lessons in chemistry, though. I don't think it's going to do tomorrow and tomorrow and tomorrow. I would still bet on the brand name imprints doing what they know how to do, making their bets across a bunch of stuff and seasonality. I still think that makes the most sense.
Yeah, I would bet that way also, because even thinking about an influencer who has 1 million followers, if you can get a piece of content about that book in front of every single one of your 1 million followers, online sales conversion rates tend to be about 2%.
And that's post-click.
So like,
anyway, sorry.
And that's post-click, right. Yeah, no, I feel you. Yeah. So like the top end of what would be reasonable to expect from an influencer who could show a thing to 1 million people, like you knew 1 million people's eyeballs were on it, is to sell 20,000 copies.
It's not happening.
That's not a failure for a debut title, but it's not a runaway success.
Yeah.
And that's the top end. Like, that's not going to happen. Catherine Buttigieg's 200,000 Instagram followers on her personal account, or her 12,000 on her book club account, like that's 2% of those people, if they all saw it, buying the book is not going to make a book into a sensation. So they're hoping, I think, for follow on.
That's what it is. They're hoping that their floor is higher.
They're hoping,
right, that they can get to the base number higher and faster.
They're hoping they can engineer word of mouth by starting it from a bigger mouth.
Right. Yeah, I mean, I kind of imagine there's some threshold of awareness and attention that a book has to pass even to become a candidate for word of mouth, right? Enough people have to have heard about you even to have that virality. And people forget that virality is a coefficient that comes from, well, we all became experts in epidemiology, right? Like a viral coefficient.
Right.
That R factor is like, does it infect? Does it touch more than one person, right? If someone hears, clearly this happened with it ends with us. Is that for every person that read it, more, you know, people recommended on past that. And then and that happened on the videos as well. That's just very hard to do. And the hope
it's
is
very
that,
rare.
Like I said, I've said this before, it's a lottery ticket so you can buy a lottery ticket, right? It's a lottery ticket to get to that threshold in which you're a candidate to become word of mouth, because there's enough sort of baseline awareness that the kind of people that might talk about your book would talk about it. Maybe they're thinking, if we can have a higher hit rate to that level, then we'll have a higher hit rate for the level above it. And the gating function is just to get to be a candidate for word of mouth. if you have more candidates up there, then more of them get. I just don't think that's going to happen. And you and I, we're thinking of this from our own business point of view here too. We are mm-hmm. super not interested in investing in distribution platforms that can change on a whim and change the algorithm, and we don't control. Like, one reason we like newsletters and podcasts, they're hard to get people into, but once they're into them, you know, TikTok can't decide because of a server change that hashtag BookTok is something that they control, right, all the time. And that's a difficult proposition to get in as well. And the second thing about word of mouth, and I swear I'll get off this, we're going to do the whole episode about follow-up, which is fine, it was a light week anyway, is that word of mouth people aren't going to, they're not going to go to bindery.com/influencerx/titlex.
Absolutely.
The book has to be at Target. The book has to be mm-hmm. at Barnes & Noble. And I don't know that Bindery has a distribution platform to get the books in there. And here's another thing. Even if they are, Barnes & Noble does not put your book on an end table and say, you know what, you get 100% of that purchase price. They take 40%. They take 50% of that purchase price. And you know what that affects? Net revenue. So yep. Maybe on sales through Bindery.com, they have a better margin because Bindery gets to pick that up in that sales. But to be word of mouth, you got to be able to find it wherever you go. It has to be on Amazon. It has to be other places.
Yeah. Yeah, any place, any time that a customer has to like create an account at a new place they've never seen before. Forget about it. Like, although, and we know this, people listening to this episode, you know this, like, you have clicked on a book title somewhere on the internet in your reading life and landed at like publishinghousename.com/the title.
Right.
And from there, you have seen, you can buy this book directly from us, the publisher, or you've been given a list of buttons for Amazon and Barnes & Noble and Bookshop and all the usual suspects. And what you probably did at that point was just close the window.
Yep.
Most people bounce if there's an extra click required. Maybe you clicked on one of the retailers, and if you did, there's like a 90% chance that it was Amazon.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a central tension in just how books get sold online, because the most effective thing to do if you actually want the sale and you're a publisher advertising a book is to link it to Amazon, because that is the place that most readers
right.
have existing accounts. So there's no friction in their, you know, there's no friction between, oh, that book looks interesting, maybe I'll buy it, and here I am at the page where I can do one click and buy it.
Mm-hmm.
Every click that you add into that process, requiring them to navigate between a bunch of other pages, decreases drastically the likelihood that they are going to buy that book. But since publishing also has to play the politics game of indie bookstores get mad at you if you link your title directly to Amazon, and other retailers don't like it if you link your book directly to Amazon, they're going to drop you at a landing page that has all these retailers to choose from. So kind of everybody feels better about it, but you sell fewer books in the long run that way.
Right.
And Bindery is going to be up against that, plus the fact that like readers won't really know what Bindery is if they land at bindery.com in a way where, like, if you land at penguinrandomhouse.com, you do know that's a publisher.
Yeah, it's $14.99 ebook. Well, they have to charge sales tax depending on your jurisdiction. And oh, by the way, I'm doubting shipping is free on a $14.99.
And what's their ebook distribution platform?
I'm sure, I mean, they're probably going to be, you know, some bespoke login, and it's going to be DRM. This is a, look, it's a hard business. So, you know, publishers struggle with this too. I'm not saying, I'm not saying they don't. But I think any experimental publishing model has to take a risk. I think this is a risk worth taking, but most risks like this don't pan out. And I think, I'm not sure I have motivated reasoning, but I don't particularly care for most of the kinds of books that tend to be TikTok hits. I don't particularly like that content format just for regular stuff. So, you know, take all I'm saying with, you know, a full dash of the Morton salt shaker. Ron Swanson dash of salt to go with my take. But I think for those of you who are listening, like, I hope it's interesting to think about what the realities of publishing are and what you're, there's no free lunch. So you're trading something for something, and what they're trading for is interesting, but I think it's worth thinking about what they're trading away to open up that percentage or open up those platforms or distribution.
It's a good way to wrap that up.
All right, let's do Frontless Foyer, but one last sponsor break. Should we talk about, so you did both Patchett and McBride.
I did.
Should we do McBride together first before moving into Patchett, or do you want to take it the other way?
Well, I pitched Patchett a little bit last week, so we can just talk about James McBride.
Well, let me say this. Just telling Michelle the ending of the book made her cry.
I have not attempted to talk about the book until right now.
Shall I ask you to relate the end here? Yeah?
Oh, God.
Right.
We're not going to, we can't spoil it, but oh, boy.
It's moving. It's sad and moving at the end. I think it's also exuberant. The beginning is exuberant.
It is.
If I have a critique of this book, it's maybe the first 15 or 20 pages are a little impenetrable. Impenetrable is the right wrong word, but it takes a little while to get into the community of Chicken Hill. We have a flashback, you know. He does a curiosity gap thing, and not in a BuzzFeedy kind of cheap way, but there's a body. Mm-hmm. We don't know who it is. And a lot of the book is sort of loosely the point of saying who that is, but it's also totally not at the same time.
Yeah. I think that's my only quibble as well, that like it starts with the body. Yeah. And then you get all these rewinds and you start meeting the other characters, the other people who live in this place. And somewhere about halfway through the book, I was like sending a link to it to a friend. And so I saw the synopsis online that's like, a body is discovered and then you spend the rest of the time figuring out who it was. And I was like, oh, right, I'm halfway through this book and I have forgotten that the point of this is to figure out who that body is, which is honestly turns out to be like kind of totally fine.
Right.
Like, I don't think it doesn't need the mystery box component that introduces, because the rest of the characters are so... Like, once you get into it, the characters are so just fully realized and complicated and lovely. And this community that they're in Pennsylvania, Pottstown, Pennsylvania, in the mid to late 1930s, we're seeing primarily Jewish and Black characters and the tensions between them, but also the relationships between them and how they deal with the primarily white folks who run the town, because it's the 1930s. Just really interesting. I was telling you the vibe of the book maybe reminded me the most of Sula. Mm. It's not quite, there's nothing like surreal in it the way that Sula has some surreal, like slightly surreal elements, but that small town with these fully realized, like real characters. So the kind of people that you say, oh, she's a character, like everybody is one of those. But not in a, it's not like they're not outsized, they're not caricature-ish.
No, that's important, because we said, you know, McBride's corpus is extensive and very accomplished. And it's easy to compare him to someone like Colson Whitehead. I mean, it really started with Deacon King Kong and Harlem Shuffle coming out the same time, because mm-hmm. they're both writing something similar, but their own stylistic and thematic differences came so far across. Whitehead is so much more, I'm not even sure how to say it, controlled. McBride is much more exuberant, right? There's a reason he's drawn to John Brown, which we talked a little bit on First Edition, like this larger than life, but also very specific character. At the same time, so these characters are funny, they're flawed, they have big and specific and recognizable personalities and ambitions. Mm-hmm. And I think the central pleasure of much of McBride, and I think especially this one, is sort of walking amongst them as they're doing their stuff. And the plot matters less to me. The situations matter less insofar as the stage upon which they tread. And that's pretty high recommendation for me, I would say. Just, you want to spend time with the characters it creates. It becomes pretty clear to me in talking with him that, like, he finds characters and then, right? That's how kind of it works.
Mm-hmm.
This book was an outgrowth of a book he was trying to write that was about something else, and it didn't work. But the one thing that worked was Moshe in this character. For the other, if you Rebecca, you read it, but the other, like that character worked, and that became the hook and entree into this other
interesting
world. So if you like character, especially, you're gonna like this. I figured out pretty quickly who the body was, and I don't think that matters. You know, I mean, if that kind of thing. If you're looking for a mystery, like, I guess there's a little bit of that there. I would think it's pretty thin gruel for a pretty hardcore mystery, murder mystery kind of lover.
I mean, I'm, you know, so historically bad at guessing the whodunit in mysteries, and I forgot this was even a mystery.
Right.
That, like, at near the end when the pieces were tying up, I did see, like, oh, I know where this is going. And that didn't impact the reading experience at all, because it really is not about solving the mystery. This is not a mystery book. It just happens to have like a question mark at the start of it. But the relationships between all of these characters that McBride unwinds throughout, like, that's the point. The point is, just as you were saying, to, like, to be among these people. And the more I thought about it, the more I thought, like, I think this is one of the reasons that McBride is one of those authors that for me does work better on the page than in any kind of imagined adaptation. And I watched the Good Lord Bird adaptation with Ethan Hawke, and like, he captured the zaniness of the character and the book about as well as a person could. But there's something to the vibe of McBride that just, I think, works better as a reading experience that you're dwelling in and that you get to feel the language of. If it just relies on dialogue and scenery and action the way that television tends to, you lose a lot of that, like, the real sparkle of these characters and the experience of, like, I always feel like when you're reading James McBride, you can just feel the, like, little twinkle in his eye while he was sitting there at the keyboard.
I was thinking about that. There's many great characters, but one that stuck out to me in this book is a character who goes by Paper, which is short for newspaper, which is, she becomes the,
the town gossip.
Yeah, the informational hub of the city. And the pleasure he takes in describing her and her demeanor and how she delivers. In a film adaptation, that encounter with a character is over instantly. You see their whole body. You see their mannerisms. But in describing it in prose, you have to slow down. You get to be specific and play. And McBride is a great describer of character. It clearly relishes that. But when it's on screen, like, you see Ethan Hawke's visage and you see his character and you see his hangdog kind of look, but also this wild, it's like over so fast. But part of the pleasure with McBride is like lingering in those description moments because it's just fun. He's clearly having his own kind of literary portraiture. That's fun. And you don't get that as often as you might think.
That's right. That's a great way to put it. It's so good. This is going to be in contention for my favorites.
Yeah, I can see why the booksellers like it. It has an indie book because it's upmarket, would you say, more than Lit Fic?
I mean,
this is, you know, I don't know who anyone cares about this. I'm mostly just trying to figure out for myself.
I think it's on that line. Like, I won't be surprised if this is nominated for some awards this year. Where, like, I would be surprised to see
it wasn't upmarket, but I hear what you're saying.
That's true. The quality of the writing is so good, but it's so much fun to read that I think it kind of disguises it.
Right.
Like, it looks easier than it is. He makes it look easier.
I think that's
than
a great
is.
Point. I think this seems like it's breezier in talking to him, how much research goes into this. And then he just sort of, you know, he does a whole bunch of research. He said for Good Lord Bird, he'd read 50 books on John Brown, and he takes copious notes, but he doesn't refer to them. He just sort of, that becomes kind of his cognitive toolkit or his recipe or larder, and he just sort of pulls from it as he goes. And I think that that really comes across in how these are put together, because I think it is, it does seem breezier and therefore easier, but breezy ain't easy. Is for sure.
Right, and it's not breezy light subject matter, so it's quite a trick to make a book that's about complex relationships between two marginalized communities during a very fraught time of American history. And that also deals with sexual assault in one place and child abuse. Like, to take all of those things and put them in a story that you can walk away from being delighted that you spent, what, 5-7 hours of your life with is very difficult. And that is, I think that's craft, you know, in at a really high level. Maybe this is also why McBride ends up being criminally underappreciated, is the books are so enjoyable that it's easy to forget how difficult it is to create something like that. But I think this one, it can be literary in that way. Like, at the level of the writing is certainly literary. What he's working with is literary, and I would be delighted to see it nominated for some awards. For, like, to bring it back to the Patchett McBride false binary that we've created. Like,
well, it's not a false binary; it's a boxing match.
You know, and Patchett is also no stranger to a book award, but I would be I would be much more surprised to see, like, all right, actually, Tom Lake was an enjoyable, fun read. I would be disappointed in this boxing match to see Ann Patchett come out on the critical acclaim side higher than this James McBride.
It wouldn't be
book.
About
this
the combatants, it's just a better about book. The judges in that
right. outcome. Exactly, yes.
Yeah, McBride, I was thinking about, too, he's personally an optimistic person, and the books come across as optimistic, but it's also not naive. And I think a lot of people, and this is a, you know, this is, as long as I've been following middle brow and up high culture, sophistication is often equated with dourness or seriousness or
cynicism.
Negativity.
Yeah.
And I think, yeah, the comic, his comic sensibility, but also his not, he knows the realities of the world. I think it make people may read it, or it gets dinged for not being quote unquote sophisticated as, and I'll use something I really like the Underground Railroad or the Water Dancer,
sure.
Which are sophisticated.
It doesn't feel like homework. Yeah.
But this is more centrally optimistic about people, about community, about the possibility. This book is not about overthrowing the man. This is about connecting to your neighbor and what that can and can't do. And maybe it's enough. Maybe that's enough.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It may not be justice, but maybe it's enough for something good to happen. And maybe sensibility-wise, I relate to that. But I think it's not the kind of thing that wins you a Nobel.
No.
So,
yeah.
You know, whatever.
But maybe a Pulitzer, National Book
Award.
Yeah,
or, you know, he
be
won those. He got a Pulitzer, you know, for Good Lord Bird. I think some of that, too, was that Good Lord Bird was...
That's a recognition of corpus, too.
Yeah. But there's something about that portrayal, and it's 417 pages long. That felt to me... I think people were seeing in that the real... I don't even know what to... It's a precociousness, the prodigiousness of vision there. And Heaven Knows Grocery Store, it feels more... It feels smaller. Feels more... It's more about community than Good Lord Bird.
It
really is. All
it's
right.
beautiful.
That's enough. Go forth and check that out if you want. You can find show notes here, bookriot.com/listen. Choose an email podcast at bookriot.com. You can check out First Edition. Rebecca and I do. Already up is the August It Book Knockout Round. You're going to hear a lot of the same McBride Patchett stuff, though I think neither of us had read them at that point, so you can go back in time there.
Nope.
McBride coming out on First Edition next week. We are recording right after this for Patreon. We're going to do a look ahead to adaptations that are coming out this fall, and kind of talk about how confident we are in each one of them. And I don't know if we're going to do the scoreboard, but we'll kind of use the director, actor, source material. And then I think all of these have a trailer at this point, the one we're talking about. So we have a little taste. We have a free sample and talk about what we think looks like our best bets for the fall. Rebecca, thank you as always.